The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
3 years ago, I gave my first talk, which is supposed to be is traditionally called the pathfinding talk. So once I found IMC, I found the path, and once you're sort of being on it, so I said a little bit at that time about what brought me to the path and how my practice is going, how my family and my background affect my practice, etc. So that was almost 3 years ago. So since then, I have been intensifying my practice, and so this is the first time that I have come for a regular talk. So I'm not that familiar with most of you. So if you don't mind, can I ask a few questions and you can just raise hands so I get an idea of what the audience is like. I know today is the 3rd of July, so beginning of a long weekend. So especially thank you for coming. I mean, given all the things that you could have done, you have come to practice the Dharma, and I deeply appreciate that. So right at the beginning, I would like to say I bow to the Buddha within you all. So how many people here have 5 or more years of practice? How many of you have 2 or more years of practice? Just 2 to 5. How many of you have done retreats of 10 days or longer? Okay, so it's a different crowd than I thought. So I have just come back from a 3-week retreat. This is my 5th spring retreat. I am a sufferer of chronic pain, so I'm not going to be one of those teachers who really sit still. I'm going to move around a little bit. In fact, just sitting on a cushion, being able to sit on a cushion, has been an amazing result for me. And the result comes for me mostly from meditation practice. So my yoga practice was supposed to take care of my body, and then my meditation practice take care of my stress and my mind. But I'm far more committed to my meditation practice than my yoga practice. And so I definitely do at least one meditation sit a day, even if it's sometimes 10 minutes. And that's been true only over the last few years. And yoga, I usually get around to only doing in my yoga class on Sundays, if I do manage to go to the class. And I was in a car accident about 13 years ago. And I, of course, grew up sitting down on the floor all the time because I grew up in India. But after the car accident, sitting even up here without back support was impossible. My back used to just shake. So about 3 months ago, I thought maybe my back is ready enough that I will buy this cushion that I'm sitting on. I'm very attached to it, so I brought my own. And I thought I would, you know, at home I would put it down next to my meditation chair and I would sit on it for 10 minutes and I would move to the chair for the rest of the sit. And I found that once I started doing meditation, I didn't have to move. I could sit down there for the whole hour, and then sometimes hour and a half, and sometimes 2 hours. And this last 3-week meditation retreat that I did, I basically sat only on the cushion. And I had to shift after 45 minutes, put my right leg up, but I think that's more like older age, middle age, rather than my accident. So that has been an amazing journey for me, and that has happened because of my meditation practice. So we say, you know, the body and mind are sort of a continuum. That's what we are sort of discovering in the West. But the Eastern tradition, the Buddhist tradition, says it is all mind. Everything is mind. Everything originates and ends in the mind. Now, what that exactly means, I slowly understand more and more of. Now, where they say this is mostly in very traditional Buddhist temples and monasteries and societies. And so the retreat that I just took is one of my annual spring retreats that I always take in a Buddhist country, always, right here in the Bay Area. So what that means is that somewhere in this Bay Area, and I'll tell you where, there's a hidden little gem, going to which is like going to a Buddhist country. So it's amazing. You come out of that place and you hit the Walmart. So it's really in the midst of it all. It's a community started by Vietnamese immigrants in the Bay Area. Started in 1991. It's called the Tathagata Meditation Center, TMC for short. You can see them on the web. Tathagata is another name for the Buddha. And so I thought, it's such a different experience, though I thought I would tell you a little bit about it. So it's more like a travelogue, but of course it's a spiritual travelogue. So is that going to be okay? Would that be all right? So it's full of adventure and exotic things and exotic experiences, but it is also, I hope, inspiring. So the Tathagata Meditation Center is a very traditional monastery and meditation center run by Vietnamese people, as I said, supported, completely voluntary supported, just as the IMC is, but it's more remarkable because they hold 4 long retreats a year, plus 1 long retreat for children, 1 long retreat for youth, and they hold at least 1 or 2 weekend retreats every month. So, and they prepare the food over there. There are women who are basically dedicated their lives to this volunteerism, and they provide fantastic food for all the yogis and all the monks. There are Vietnamese monks there. That are under tutelage, basically, but the top level, the main philosophy is Theravadan, and it is Burmese. So some of these Vietnamese people went to Burma, and they felt that the Burmese Theravadan monks really had the scientific, perfected way of teaching that got very quick results. And that's exactly the style in which IMC also teaches. It's called the Mahasi. If you haven't heard, it's Mahasi, M-A-H-A-S-I, Mahasi tradition. Mahasi was the name of a monk in the early part of this century. I think he went up to 1940s or 50s. He studied with many masters, and he combined their knowledge and then took the best from everything and made his own tradition. And in that particular style of meditation became so effective that their monastery came to be termed in the West as the first enlightenment factory. So it's first enlightenment is called stream entry or sotapanna. So that came to be known as the stream entry factory. It at least got you very quickly to the first enlightenment stage. So this is the TMC is basically run under that philosophy. The direct descendant of Mahasi Sayadaw is somebody called U Pandita. U means teacher, and Pandita is the long name I forget is the name of the place. So basically it means the main teacher from Pandita Rama something. So U Pandita is the main teacher, current living teacher in that tradition. And he comes there every year. He has been coming almost every year since 1991 to teach the spring retreat. So going to TMC and you close the gate behind, you really have to close the gate behind so that retreatants are not affected by. So they have these 2 large gates. You drive your car and you close the gate behind. You are in another world. It is middle of this city hubbub and you hear police sirens and everything, but you also hear roosters crowing in the morning because there's Vietnamese community around there and lots of people are growing chickens and nobody's neighbor is clearly complaining of the rooster noise early in the morning. So it's kind of delightful for me. It kind of reminds me of India and the roosters crowing in the morning. That's the meditation center and monastery in a very traditional way that even the Buddha, if he descended there today, would recognize. He said, yeah, this is a Buddhist Theravada. You know, he wouldn't say Theravada, he would say this is a Buddhist monastery and meditation center. And of course, there are cars and things like that. So it's very traditional. And in many ways, therefore, very orthodox. But it is a Buddhist meditation center and monastery, and therefore, there's no such thing as just plain orthodox. Things are always more interesting in a Buddhist monastery and meditation center. And That is because what they're teaching is Buddhism, and it was Buddha who was one of the earliest strong empiricists, right? He said, does anybody know his famous sutta in which he said, do not rely on all these things, but only rely on your own experience? It's called the Kalama Sutta. It's a very famous sutta. It's called Kalama Sutta. It's almost called like a charter for self-inquiry in Buddhism. And it's in the Anguttara Nikaya, which is one of the Buddhist texts. So this is what he said. And when Buddha says this, he says it so thoroughly, so I can't really remember, so I have it written down. This is what he says. So he said, don't go by reports, by legends, by traditions, by scripture, by logical conjecture, by inference, by analogies, by agreement through pondering, through views, by probability, or by the thought that this contemplative is our teacher, so what he says or she says must be right. So that covers quite a ground. I mean, forget traditions, forget scripture, but forget logical conjecture. This is not to be arrived at through logical conjecture. There's nothing about this is logical. Insights that you get are not logical. They are purely experiential. They are not to, cannot be derived by inference. There are no analogies to it. And there's nothing about probability here. So, you know, if you do the practice, you do the practice sincerely, you will get insights and you will get them in a certain order. How many of you know that you get these insights in a certain order? Always in a certain order. Always. So these are called the common insights that everybody going, doing the Theravada tradition, doing this particular kind of practice will get. You will also get a bunch of other insights, some of them pertaining to your own life, and some of them you will get a little bit here, a little bit there, and some people might just jump over. But, for example, I had some insights regarding elements. You know, there in Buddhism there are basic elements, like four or five. So I basically got insights early on about the five elements in the body, that the body is made of five elements, that not everybody gets. But there are the main insights that are supposed to lead you to freedom, everybody gets. So it's a purely empirical and therefore a purely scientific and purely objective endeavor. And that is something, in spite of being a very orthodox and a very traditional monastery, deeply appreciated, emphasized and focused on at TMC, and which is very interesting and remarkable. So here are some of the differences. You know, you guys, the only sort of ritual we all do is take off our shoes and leave our tea outside, mostly because we don't want to spoil the carpet. So truly the ritual part of it is leaving our shoes outside, which is an old tradition from India. The roads being dusty and dirty, you didn't want to, you know, bring all that germs and stuff to either the house or the temple. So that's the only tradition pretty much that we do. Everything else sort of we have created along the way. And we appreciate that. I deeply appreciate that. I mean, I don't think I would have gone straight to a place like TMC and been comfortable. There's a big golden Buddha. As you enter the hall, almost everybody bows just as they enter. Once you sit and the teacher comes, then you do three bows all the way down to the floor. And then they'd also do, once they start the meditation, they do three bows all the way down to the floor. Those three bows before meditation are to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, the triple gems of Buddhism. Also, once they finish their meditation, they bow to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. When you go to the interview, you always take off your headgear or whatever, and you go with your bowed hands. As far as possible, you don't even make eye contact with the teacher. You sit down, you bow three times, then with your hands folded if possible, you give the interview, then you bow three times again, and almost not showing them that your back, you know, almost like, you know, to the king, you sort of, you know, with the bowed hand go out. But they are extremely scientific. The Mahasi tradition, one of the most interesting things about Mahasi tradition was that he taught so many people. And he made very clear observations, and he took notes. And he teaches all of his monks and nuns. There are also nuns also don't teach as such, but they interview female devotees. So I had the pleasure of being interviewed by a few nuns. And they know in this tradition, as I said, everybody gets the same insights in the same order. And they even know the sub-insights and the sub-levels that you're going to go through. And so they know exactly where you are when you tell them where, you know, what experience you are having, and they can warn you about what's coming up because they know exactly what's going to happen, all based on just X number of samples, right? Lots and lots of people taught, reported back, and so they created this nice hierarchy of what exactly you will expect. So I had gone, and then I reported to the teacher, and he said to me, he's one of my favorite teachers called Ujjatila. He's a younger man, as in he is in his 40s. He's way tall. I thought he was an American football player or something who had turned, but because he's kind of dark and he's very tall, but he's Burmese. And he said to me, you will have now a few experiences. You will see things or you will hear things in the next few days, and I want you to not get involved in it, not be scared by it, not get angry with it, not get upset with it, but just note it. So I really deeply appreciate that. How is it very empirical and how is it very scientific? First, this was just the data collection that they did. They understand that this is just data collection. It was purely empirical based on the reports of the number of people, right? So it's kind of like an empirical science. On this particular method, they just gathered a whole bunch of examples. One of the teachers, I went and bowed and, you know, then started giving my report. And we, on long retreats, we have interviews once a day, every day, every single day. So I did my report and I said, I have this energy, you know, I still have the yoga tradition and I do some Reiki, and so I have this, you know, I have this way of thinking and speaking. So he says, I have this energy that's at the base of my spine and it's been sort of whirling around. So I was very pleased because, you know, I could really feel that. I know about Kundalini, and I said, wow, I'm really getting somewhere. So I'm reporting that very happily. And usually he's so kind. He just smiles and says, good, good, good. And you just, you know, keep the practice. Here he was very cross. He says, what's energy? So, you know, I thought maybe it was a translation problem, and I'm trying to think, what's energy? So he said, you know, energy, power. He says, what's power? So I'm trying to say, okay, how am I going to translate? How am I going to say this? I thought, you know, his English is a little poor. And then he says, is this something you taste? Is this something you smell? Is this something you see? Is this something you hear? Is this something that touches you? So tell me what he meant was, don't give me a concept. Energy is a concept. We do not want a concept. We want to know exactly what you feel. As soon as you call it energy, you have changed it. And from here on, calling it energy, you are going to be one place removed from that experience. He wants the real empirical experience. So I said, oh, okay. I said, I feel it in the body. Good, he says. Anything else? I said, yes, I see it. Even if my eyes are closed, I see it. He said, okay, what color is it? So I had to tell him what color it was. And he said, you feel it in the body. Is it heavy? Is it light? Is it wet? Is it dry? Is it knocking? Is it still? Is it? Then I had to tell him exactly how I felt it in my body. And I was just so, I came out, I, you know, did the bows and I came out and I said, wow, this is great. It's like my lab teacher might say, it's like, you know, you jumped to the conclusion too quickly. It's like you didn't record your lab experiment perfectly. I said, I understand this. I can do this. This is great. So time and again, I have basically, people wanted me to report three things that I noticed about reporting to the teachers. A, they did not want your life story. They did not want to know about how your life was with your mother, or whether you get along with your neighbor or not, or if you are having financial problems right now, unless it's going to affect your being on the retreat. So leave your life outside. Number two is, Focus on the basic technique, which is during walking meditation, lifting and putting your foot down. Nothing else. You don't note anything else. You hear a bird, you ignore it. You're only going to place. When you sit down, most of your attention will be on the rising and falling of the abdomen, rising, falling. But if you're pulled away to something else, including the bird song, then you note hearing, and then you go back. You do not say bird. Because who knows if it's a bird or if it's somebody whistling like a bird. All you know is that you're hearing. So you do not say bird. You say hearing, and then you go back. That is your only reality. The third thing is, whatever you hear, you see, you feel, you think, you touch, you do not have a reaction. You're watching it as objectively as you can. You're not going to make it your own. It's almost like You are the space alien with amazing powers who has come down on Earth to look at what human beings are like. And he has this power, or she has this power, that can enter your body and get in touch with everything that you can feel, hear, smell, taste, think. But it's not you, so it doesn't care about it. But it's very careful noter, so it notes, oh, I taste something. I smell, you know, this person smells something in the kitchen and is now hungry or salivating, but doesn't get hungry herself or himself almost. So you're supposed to look at your body, your experience, as though it is somebody else. So basically, do not get involved. Do not make an I or me, it's my experience, out of it. Truly like a person observing a lab in the, I mean, the rat in the lab, to which you have no particular connection or empathy, you are going to watch. And they emphasize this so much. It is amazing. Over and over again, the teachers had to tell me, I don't want to hear that. They would say, come back. What did you notice about rising and falling? What did you notice when you were walking? Don't tell me about whether you were, you know, you're missing your mother or not. Really, over and over. Focus, focus, focus. So I really started telling myself, just the facts, ma'am. Wasn't that the line that the CID and Columbo, yeah, right. So I started telling myself, just the facts, ma'am, just the facts. And so I had this funny picture of this Burmese monk with this, you know, rope saying, just the facts, ma'am, you know. And really, really being objective, and that they really emphasize. Because this whole practice is for getting towards freedom, right? This whole practice is not actually for stress reduction, which is very nice, very early on. But when you taste real freedom, or you taste real peace, then you know what this practice is really about. And I have to tell you, I have only tasted just a little bit of it. It's not really come and stayed with me yet. But even then, it just blows you away. That's how important, how big it is. And it's really worth striving for. So these teachers can sometimes, you know, feel really, really cruel. But they are not. What they're trying to do is trying to make you focus on the process, because they know the process leads to the end that they have themselves tasted, and they know exactly how precious it is. So you have this precious time you're taken away from your heavy, involved, worldly life, and they want you to use it to the maximum. And they really, really believe it, because that's all they do. That's what some of them got to the monastery when they're 5 or 6 years of age. And most of them went voluntarily. They didn't go, you know, because their parents made them. So that's all they know. And they have, most of them have gone very, very far and very deep into it. And so they really, really believe it. They really know. And they have seen over and over again, people like us, even Westerners, caught in our lives, what freedom can really bring, what happiness. So if I got involved, I got upset, all they said was, did you note that you were upset? So if you see something over which you're crying, you're supposed to note the fact that you're seeing something. So seeing, then you're supposed to note the emotional reaction, upset. And if you need to, then say noting. So I laugh. It's like I could go and tell them I had this vision where I was pummeled at by a lion, and then a whole group of people came and tied me to a stake, and this tribe took me and they tied me to the pole, and there was this firing around me. They were going to burn me. And he would say, okay, what did you feel? I was tearing my hair out. So I was really upset. I was really scared. So did you note scared? That's all. You know, scared. And we used to laugh about it, I used to get upset about it. It's taken me many years to really deeply appreciate what that means. They're just telling me over and over. Because equanimity is the goal, and peace is the goal. Equanimity means being able to stand still in the midst of enormous joy or enormous pain, or alternating every moment, as our life really seems to be. And equanimity is not something that you get to somewhere by climbing this ladder slowly. Equanimity is something you really have to develop slowly yourself until it comes and stays with you permanently. But it won't come and stay with you permanently, which only happens, by the way, after the last final stage of enlightenment, but it comes at you very, very slowly as you develop it, and they want you to develop it. So this constant refrain, did you note it? Did you note it? Did you note it? Did you note it? And you will have all kinds of experience. The whole plethora of human experience is something you will go through. Experiences that you had in this lifetime, experiences that you had never had and seem as if they might be from your previous lives, or different are that are like dreams, the enormous joy and ecstasy and almost sexual feelings and happiness and you, everything, the whole gamut. And all you're supposed to do is very quietly sit there and note it. And I really appreciated that only last year. You know, as they say, as people are dying, they see their life. Many, many cultures believe you see the reel of your life, this current life, pass through. And neuroscientists say that you have all of your memories intact in your brain. What you do lose is the way to access them. And at least that seems to be true. At least that the, you know, the latter part of it. I saw images of my daughter since the time she was born until now, and details, like I'm seeing Maureen right now, what as real as Maureen is, I have seen my daughter at various stages, which I did not think I remembered. And last year, I was very close to my father. My father passed away about 9 years ago. A deep spiritual, intellectual, emotional connection with my father. He was like he was one of the big people in my family, in my life, and my mother and my husband and of course my daughter, but now she's getting there. Four people, and he was a very big one. He was the first big influence in my life. I was very deeply affected by his death, and I'm sure part of my chronic pain was also this not being able to grieve. I brought my mother here and looked after her and all that, and basically left that culture there. So it's like partly grieving for him, partly grieving for my life in India and all that together. So anytime his name would be brought up or I would read anything about him, I would just get tearful every time. Sometimes I would forget and I'd pop like a tape that he had made for me of music. And I was like, oh my God, I'm driving down the highway and I'm like, tears are streaming down my face. And never mind how many years of meditation I've done. So finally last year, I saw images of him. I mean, they were so, it's like exactly seeing any one of you really close. And from the time I was like 6 or 7 till the last time that I saw him. And it was so intense. It was so real. It was like he was there. And my teacher has said, now what you will see, the second time around, another teacher has said, now you will see a bunch of stuff and make sure that you don't get upset, especially don't cry. And there was a woman, the whole bunch of us go through this together. There was a woman who was crying all the time. He says, don't do that. So I said, okay, I won't. Okay. So tears started coming. He's there. It's like, I can see, I can touch him. And I said, okay, I'm going to be a good meditator. I'm just going to note, crying. So it's like for 25 minutes or half an hour, it's like crying. I said, I'm good. I'm saying crying. Then I go and report to him the next day. So I said, okay, yeah, just like you mentioned, I saw this on my father. And I was, so what did you do? I said, I started crying. He said, oh. I said, no, but I noted crying. So he said, very good. So how long did that go on? I said, 35 minutes. He says, 35 minutes, you were noting crying. That doesn't mean you were indulging in crying and you were trying to note crying. He said, if you truly noted, it would have lasted a minute. And he looked at me, Smita, he said, did you know that if you had truly noted objectively, quietly, you would have been free of that sorrow forever? And I said, I wish you had told me that. But you know, in spite of 35 minutes of, as he called, indulging in crying, I said, I thought you don't understand, my father has passed away. He says, yeah, I understand, of course, why else would you cry? I said, I was very close to him. I said, of course, why else would you cry? He said, in the morning, we do loving kindness for our parents, and at night, we have this one line for, that's all we bring our parents into this, whether alive or dead, loved dearly or not. And then he looks up, he's very ferocious, and suddenly he changes and says, you know, my dear, he didn't say my dear, but that's a dollar tone. You know, this is what it's all about, he says, the prayer, right? So So he said, about freedom, right? You decide what you want. You've been a long practitioner, right? So he said, okay, try, okay. No problem, try. So then I come out. And in spite of that indulgent in crying and 35 minutes, it's still, somebody mentions my father, I can talk about my father and not get tearful. I'm very grateful because what it is used for. Because I still feel everything that I feel for him. I'm very grateful for the person that he was, but he is gone, and I'm here, and I'm leading my life, and it's that sorrow is of no use. At least wasn't anymore. I was done with it. It was not like immediate. It was, 9 years. I didn't want to carry it to the rest of my life. So it was done. So, I'll tell you a few personality quirks from there. I mean, there are just so many stories. So this Ujjatila, the 44-year-old football player looking guy. So Upandita himself, he's about 86 right now. He's very old, very old style, very ferocious. He's very ferocious. So there's no hand holding. And he admits it. Now he's older, he admits it. And he used to be even more ferocious than he is. Even I have seen the progression in the last 5 years. So on this retreat, and I'm trying, first retreat, I'm in so much pain, I'm trying really hard. Everybody is, right? Everybody really, really putting their effort. And on the 10th day, he says, if you haven't gotten tranquility, if you haven't gotten concentration by now, go home, he says. In the talk, he says, if you haven't gotten concentration now, you're wasting your time. You're not having fun, you're not enjoying worldly fun, and you're not getting any benefit. So that's the kind of a person he is. But that's just how he is personized, and that's the kind of culture where, he's sort of the old patriot, a patriarch, and that's the sort of relations that he has. But one-on-one, he can be amazing, and he's amazingly moving, and he has power. I mean, I used to, do meditation before he came, and he was old, and he just recently had heart surgery, and he's much better now. But the bell would ring for him to come in, and he would not come in for like 10 minutes. So then I would just start doing meditation. So I didn't really have my eyes open to see when he came in, but I had to do the bowing, right? The 3 times, that's the style. But I could feel him always at the door. I could feel him. I could feel the power. And every time, and I really did not, and I still do not like his style of Dharma talks, because they are very dry and unnecessary. I'm sure he has the greatest stories on earth, and they are very repetitive, and basically they say, keep noting, and be mindful, almost for the half the retreat. And this is a very, very deeply learned man who knows not just the enormous theory and enormous practice in this particular tradition. So he really can clear concepts and deepen your understanding, but That's the way he is. He has been used. That's what he's used to, and that's what he does. But one-on-one, he's magnificent. At least he was to me. So I got to some stage. My first understanding of anatta, which is non-self, was my first understanding of anatta. So I didn't even know what it was. It was a little scary, actually. So I was one of these other teachers that I was talking to, and he was sort of like, he wasn't paying any attention. He was reading a Buddhist magazine, and they do that. These older teachers do that. They like pay no attention to you. And then this other student was translating to him, so I was basically reporting. And once I mentioned where I was, suddenly he got interested. And there are just some very interesting examples. And he looked at me. And he clearly read a lot more than you and I can see, or I can see in the mirror, or you can see me. He looked at me and says, you can sit through a lot of pain, can't you? He said. I said, yes, sir, I can. He said, you really are truly one of Buddha's people. You will go very far. He says, continue and strengthen your ability to sit through pain, which is not very auspicious, is it? So, continue your ability to sit through pain. That's very good. Then you can go very far. And then he sent me to the big guy, to Upandita. So, same thing, Upandita, go bow, etc. And I'm reporting. He is reading the suttas, as if he has never read them before, right? And I giving my report, etc. He's just like indulgent, looks at me, etc. And then suddenly I come to where I tell him about my first this thing, anatta. And he puts this away, and he looks at me, and he gives a big smile. And then he asks me all these questions. If you're Indian, he knows a lot about Indian culture, and he asks where you're from, and whatever. And then in the end, he said to me, you know, where you are is a very good place. If you are really, really, really mindful, every single task you do by the end of this retreat, you can really have a big achievement under your belt. He's one of the few teachers who really believes that if he knows you can make tremendous progress, he really tells you where you are and what you can do. Most teachers don't. I mean, not even his students. They don't all believe that. They all believe, you know, don't tell the student where that they really are, and there is no such thing as really getting to place A, but it's sort of a continuous practice, just the way sort of Gil believes. But he believes, and I really deeply appreciated that. I really tried harder because I thought I might get somewhere, and I did. So I think without his, I would have sort of continued, but, you know, I upped my effort by 150%, definitely, and I could do that. Another thing, as I was bowing and going, I got up almost. He said something, and then the translator said something I didn't understand, so I stopped by. He said, be free of this 3 foot by 3 foot by 6 foot room. So I turned back and said, what did he mean? She says, you know, 3 feet by 3 feet by 6 feet, and I burst into tears, because when he said it, when she said it, something struck in me about the bondage that we are in. And that's actually an insight. I'm still not free. That was my second retreat. This was my fifth retreat. Fifth year, and then I have one number of small retreats. It's very painful for me to talk about, but I am not free. But I've gotten a glimpse. And I know that itself is an insight, that you are locked in. Is an insight in a 3 foot by 3 foot by 6 foot or whatever your frame is. That's a deep insight, and I had it right here when I was talking to Gil. So I was first told that by Upandita, and then I had it truly as an insight. Do you guys know what an insight really is? Is something, any insight can come through any of your five senses. So you can see, you can hear, you can smell, you can taste, then you can touch. That's it. Right? Yeah. Or sometimes multiple senses are involved. You might smell something, and you might taste something, and you might see it, and you might actually even hear the name. So that's an insight in your meditation. And you hear it, it's very, very clear. When you see it, it's very clear. It is clearer than my seeing my father. It's clearer than my seeing Maureen. It's really clear. It's something you cannot mistake. It's amazing. Another thing that happens because of this focus and because of this whole orientation of this traditional monastery in San Jose is that most people have insight experiences on these retreats. On 2 week, 3 week, 4 week, 5 week retreats, most people have real insight experiences. Many people have experience of enlightenment. It's not unlikely. Many people have. And many people who come there have already had some enlightenment experiences. Many of them, because they are Buddhist, traditional Buddhists, most of them are Burmese or Vietnamese, and a few Westerners, and this one Westerner, Westernized Indian, you know, and there might be some, yeah. So when most of the people there are Buddhists, and they are deeply, deeply, fervently devoted to the Dharma and to the Buddha, and therefore they make tremendous progress, and they know and they understand, and they make the sacrifices necessary, and they just go from place to place and place to place. So you meet these meditation teachers who have gone very far, and that's basically all that they do, is to do meditation and then teach about meditation. Most of them have touched places of such deep calm, and you get to, for a moment, touch that because they are there. So my first ever interview at TMC was with Ujja Tila, the big tall guy, and I thought he was American until I went and sat down. And I don't know if I can give you a real feel for it, because it's me telling it, it's not Ujja Tila telling it, right? But let me see if I can. It's only words, and some of this stuff is beyond words, because you'll get an idea. I sat down, and he was here at the table, and he was sitting across. And so he leaned back in the chair, and he says, Smita Joshi, how is your meditation going? That's all. In sort of Burmese accent. And I had such a feeling, and I can't convey it because I don't have his voice. The reason I don't have his voice is because I haven't touched the places of deep peace that he has. You can't fake it. you have to be a really good actor, and I'm not that good an actress. So he said, how are you, how is your meditation practice going? And I really felt at that time, and I come as a, you know, as I mentioned, a really kind family and married into a really kind family. So I'm surrounded by kind, generous, wonderful people. But I felt never before in my life has anybody said something, been so accepting of me. I felt I could tell him I touched the first enlightenment stage, or I could tell him, oh, I'm having such a hard time, and it's burst into tears, or pick up the chair and throw it at him and say, this is all nonsense, and I'm getting the hell out of here. Any of those would have been okay by him. It's really, really felt that. Any of those would just like, go and sing. And that's just quite an experience. There's another old Burmese teacher called Bilin Sayadaw, who I have interviewed. That's the guy who said, what's energy? What's energy? You know. So I kept thinking, you know, I came home and, you know, I was telling my husband and my mother, so this teacher is amazing. So he has these deep blue eyes. And I stopped and I said, how can he have deep blue eyes? He's Burmese, you know. He is 100% ethnic Burmese. How can he have deep blue eyes? And then I realized that was an impression. My mind was creating a concept for conveying what his eyes were. And his eyes were like a deep ocean, basically. His eyes were so calm. They were like a deep ocean. And my mind immediately created the concept that they were deep blue. And until I really said it, I didn't realize. That's how calm he really is. And this other guy, the guy who gets angry a lot, but he says, it's okay, you know, if you've seen the picture of your, you know, father, Ukavinda, who is still there, he's very interesting. These are the younger monks, you know, and they get more friendly, and they have been really brought over, like Ujjatila was brought over, and now Ukavinda is there, so that they get much more of a Western exposure. They really get to understand what the Western culture is like, so they're supposed to be the ambassadors of Buddhism really into the West, and when Westerners go back there, they are the ones who take care of the Western retreatants in Upandita's ashram, meditation center. So this guy has such a tough persona, and he's not above berating all the yogis as to how they are not behaving or they are not, you know, walking mindfully, etc. But one-on-one, he's just such a soft heart, and you just know. And you know that these both Ujjatila and Ukavinda just felt care so deeply about how far I went. I mean, they really do. And I'm sure they do that for everybody. There's nothing special about me. It's just when, you know, I had that experience of Anatta for the first time, and I was sent off to Upandita. So my next interview was with Ujjatila. The Upandita is the older guy, Ujjatila, the football player. And he says to me, so, I heard you saw Upandita. So you saw Sayadawji, that's what they call him. You saw Sayadawji. Was he happy? He said about, I think, yeah, I think so. He says, and the end of the retreat, I went for a closing interview with him, and he says, I was so happy. You made such wonderful progress. Just wonderful. And I just, you know, I come back from my third retreat, and I tell my husband, and like on the fourth day, I say, you know, I miss my mom. So my husband says, you know, it turns out my husband is wonderful. He turns around and says, who wouldn't miss unconditional love? He said, who wouldn't miss unconditional love? So you're very lucky to have that in your life, and it's perfectly okay to miss them. So that's my travelogue to the Buddhist country in San Jose. So thank you all for listening to me. And once again, I bow to the Buddha within each and every one of you. Any questions or comments? Thank you.
Thanks for sharing your story. It was very interesting to listen to. My question is about how your meditation helps with chronic pain. Is it just mostly to coming to a place of equanimity with it, or does it actually help you to in some way overcome that, the actual pain?
For if this is not unfortunately the best meditation practice for necessarily for chronic pain is what I realized way too late, and now I'm into it, and so So there's something called samatha practice, which is more peace practice. And I don't know if it just gives you relief that is short-term while you're meditating or it's more long-term. So that's something I want to investigate because I'm interested, because I feel for everybody who has chronic pain. The first immediate thing was that happened to me was my mind quieted down. My mind was more forgiving of other people, so there was a lot less of tensing of my body because I was upset or angry or, you know, whatever. A second thing that happened was equanimity. I accepted. I used to throw tantrums because I had to give up my career very early, within 4 years of working, and I had a young child, and I was very ambitious, very career-minded, and I used to throw tantrums. So why me? Why it's not fair? You know, what am I supposed to do with myself? So that stopped pretty early. Meditation gives you a focus. It definitely gave me something very interesting to do, and something in which my type A personality could try to excel. You know, it gave me like a barrier to climb over. And long run, though, if you really want, I mean, long run, going to retreats, my ability to sit down here, that's a real relief of pain. That's a real relief of pain. That only happens if you go on long retreats. You have to first go through, on this Vipassana tradition, you have to first go through a lot of pain. But I feel I had pain anyway. So it was just a question. It's like going to the acupuncturist, you know, they poke needles, and if you have chronic pain, it hurts. But then it's like, please do it so that the rest of the week I'm pain-free. So, yeah. If you really get insights, you have to get at least a few insights. If you get 2 or 3 insights, then it really unknots and it doesn't come back. Yeah. That it takes some effort. Not that much of effort. I mean, if you look at how many years we spend in school and college for a career, you know, if you went on a 3-month retreat, it might just do it. 3 months is not, I mean, to undo your body, mind, habits, everything is not that long, in a sense. Yeah. Anything else? Okay. Thank you very much.